Where'd you get that? Does it say?
It's working good. I like it.
Now you're good.
I'm opening meeting of the House Energy and Environment Committee on Tuesday, March 17th, 2015. Welcome, everyone. Any opening comments? No, good. Opening a work session on House Bill 2447. That's the bill to extend the sunset on the tax credits for alternative energy devices. We've already adopted the Dash 1 amendment. There is no fiscal revenue. It's good. And Vice Chair Johnson.
Vice Chair Reardon, I move House Bill 2447 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation that the bill be referred to the Committee on Revenue by prior reference.
Jeff Johnson moves House Bill 2447 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Revenue by prior reference. Any discussion? Rep. Wagner's hand first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to let you know, some of these sunsets or tax credits, I feel, have done their job in the process they've taken or that they've been used for. So I'll be a no on some of these as they go forward, just to let the tax credits committee know that they need to look at these really close.
Is that
and
a
stuff.
No today or no on the floor?
That's a no today, and then I'll see on the floor. So.
Mr. Vice Chair, there were also Dash 3 amendments, I think, that we discussed in the last hearing, but I do think those have been removed because they were becoming a little more problematic than their benefits. So I just wanted to make sure members were aware of that.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay. That's what I was. Thank you. Mm-hmm. That okay. Answered mine, too.
Anybody else? Representative Beck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to, I'm going to vote for the motion, but when it gets to revenue, there's several things that I don't particularly like about the bill, and I'll be raising them then. We'll see how that goes.
Okay, well, I appreciate that. Thank you. And anybody else? Roll call, please.
Representative Hurd.
Aye.
Representative Holby.
Aye.
Representative Bentz.
Aye.
Representative Boone.
Aye.
Representative Wagner.
No.
Representative Helm.
Excuse.
Vice Chair Johnson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Reardon. Chair Reardon.
Aye.
Chair Bader Peterson.
Excuse. Okay, the motion passes. The bill is sent as amended to the Committee on Revenue. I am closing the work session on House Bill 2447. I'm opening a work session on Senate Bill 456. Yes, I am. Beth, could you remind me what that one is?
Sorry.
Yeah, thank you. Oh, I think I need to gavel there. So.
Yeah. Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 456 is the bill that you heard last week that would clarify that natural gas utilities may receive additional incentives for projects approved by the PUC under the Voluntary Emission Reduction Program. There's no revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
Okay.
Vice Chair Reardon, I move Senate Bill 456 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Is there a discussion? No, actually, I'm sorry. I'm supposed to say Rep. Johnson moves Senate Bill 456 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Now, is there a discussion? Pretty straightforward. Roll call.
Representative Hurd.
Aye.
Representative Holby.
Aye.
Representative Benz.
Aye.
Representative Boone.
Aye.
Representative Wagner.
Aye.
Representative Helm.
Aye.
Vice Chair Johnson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Reardon.
Aye.
Chair Vega Peterson.
Excused. Motion passes. And we need a carrier for that one. Do we have a volunteer?
That freshman. That freshman right there.
That's an interesting. This is really a simple, straightforward bill.
And I'll do it.
I would like to nominate Rep. Hurd for that.
Mr.
experience.
I need experience.
Thinking of you.
Yes, thank you. It's very thoughtful of you.
Mr. Chair, can we suspend the rules to allow Representative Helm to cast a vote on House Bill 2447?
Yes, is there something I'm supposed to say?
Restate his motion.
Close this work session first.
Oh, need to close that work session on Senate Bill 456.
Mm-hmm. Now, Mr. Chair, I move that we suspend the rules to allow Representative Helm to cast a vote on House Bill 2447.
Any opposition to suspending the rules to allow Representative Helm to vote on 2447? Hearing none. Representative Helm, how would you vote?
May I have a review of the other votes?
All ayes except for me, your seatmate.
I vote aye. Thank you for the accommodation.
Next time, just ask which way did Jim vote.
I thought I got a teacher friend. Grab me out of the hall.
It was odd. Okay, so we're closing something. Okay, where are we at? Okay, we are. All right. Opening a public hearing on House Bill 2193. House Bill 2193 has to do with energy storage systems. And Beth, could you provide a summary of that?
Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2193 would define energy storage systems as commercially available technology capable of retaining energy, storing energy for a period of time, and transmitting that energy after storage. It would direct the PUC to develop a program for utility companies to provide energy storage. There is no revenue impact. The fiscal impact statement has not been prepared yet. There is a dash one amendment on OLIS.
Okay, thank you very much. And I believe we had scheduled testimony from the esteemed Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee. Thank you very much for allowing me to speak on House Bill 2193. For the record, Paul Holvey, State Representative, District 8. So House Bill 2193, I'm really excited about. It is bringing the opportunity for us to look at energy storage in Oregon and to integrate more renewables into the grid by making it more flexible. This energy storage has the ability to create real resiliency on the grid, and as on site backups. It can reduce peak demand and reduce greenhouse gases and improve the reliability of electrical transmission. House Bill 2193 simply will allow the PUC to establish guidelines for energy storage procurement and then work with electric companies to implement plans to procure 5 megawatts of energy storage capacity by 2020. House Bill 2193 creates an open and transparent process with the PUC involving ratepayers, advocacy groups, industrial customers, and utilities, setting the table for stakeholders to engage in the process. It allows the PUC to minimize rate impact and assess the real value of energy storage and will serve as a future guidelines for companies procuring energy storage. It will align us with Washington and California, and hopefully will drive down the cost, and hopefully will be a blueprint for how we can move forward with renewables in the state of Oregon. It has a lot of positives to it. It does for utilities as well. It establishes a rate recovery process to recover the cost of energy storage investments. It also will open the door for federal grants, which would better allow ODO, Oregon Department of Energy, to work with utilities and the publics to get grants more quickly, and perhaps to aggregate some of their projects with the projects that we're envisioning here with the PUC. It does allow the PUC an off-ramp if a project is deemed not to be cost-effective. So it's not just forcing new supply, but making utilities figure out how to use energy storage efficiently. This is the right size for Oregon of 5 megawatts and not more than 1% of peak load by 2020. I think really now is the time for Oregon to start looking at energy storage as we see the changing horizons of the future of energy and needing to figure out ways to get more renewables onto the grid. And energy storage is really one of the bright spots of the future if we can figure out how to do it. There is a Dash 1 amendment that I had people much more expert than myself to help me with this language, and want to thank the PUC and some other stakeholders as well for helping me make this language workable. I believe there's a lot more expert testimony than myself that can answer, you know, really some of the in-the-weed questions that you may have. I've looked at this concept for quite a while, trying to figure out a way for Oregon to really launch in more wholeheartedly into dispatchable renewables and getting them onto the grid, with the idea that we do need to work towards reducing our reliance on some of the traditional forms of electrical production. So I commend this bill to you for your review, and hope you listen closely to some of the testimony and look forward to some great questions. And if you have any questions now, I'll sure take a stab at answering them.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions?
Great.
Thank you. Okay. Mr. Beltucci, could you join us? And Jason, are you also up?
I saw you starting to ask a question.
Vice Chair Reardon, Vice Chair Johnson, members of the committee, I'm Jason Eisdorfer, Program Director of the Public Utility Commission. With me is Ruchi Sadir, Senior Policy Advisor. We're really here to be a resource. We did offer some suggestions in the Dash 1, hopefully to make it the language a little bit clearer. I was going to cover energy storage very briefly, and then these folks will be smarter than me on how this is all going to work. With additional intermittent resources, renewable resources, additional focus on environment, on the energy grid, with new technologies and smart grid coming along, energy storage is really one of the key bright spots and shows of promise out there. A number of folks have thought of energy storage as the holy grail, really, of integrating renewable energy. Representative Holby went through some of the benefits. Energy storage can help balance out intermittent renewable resources and integrate them into the grid. It can bring down peak loads. It can support transmission and distribution and actually defer investment sometimes, and provides ancillary services to the grid to make the grid work more efficiently overall. Something that I think is attractive about this bill is it doesn't pick technologies. There are a number of different types of energy storage technologies out there, several different kinds of batteries, either on the customer side of the meter or the utility side of the meter, flywheels, pumped hydro, compressed air, thermal energy storage technologies. All those are as defined as within the scope of the bill. Really quickly, the PUC can think about and consider energy storage through the integrated resource planning process. Energy storage sometimes works on such small moments of dispatch that it sometimes may fall through the cracks of the normal IRP planning modeling. The PUC also does requires the electric utilities annually to produce a smart grid report to update the commission on the state of smart grid technologies and the opportunities and projects on the utility system. And energy storage is clearly a part of that smart grid discussion. And And finally, we do have, PGE did invest in a pilot demonstration project. It's the Smart Power Battery Project in Salem. It's a 5-megawatt facility, and they are, they learned, I think PGE learned through the development of that project, but also its actual application and its benefit to the system. So with that, I was going to turn it over to Rucci to go through the highlights of the bill very quickly.
Good afternoon, Vice Chair Johnson, Vice Chair Reardon, members of the committee. My name is Rucci Sudhir. As Jason mentioned, I'm the Senior Policy Advisor at the PUC. So I'll briefly cover what the PUC's implementation of this bill would look like. It would be four phases. The first phase would require the PUC to set guidelines up by January 1st, 2017. And in that phase, the PUC staff would hold workshops with stakeholders to examine the potential values of energy storage technologies and what their applications could be in the electric system. The commission would adopt guidelines after those workshops based on what was examined. The second phase would require PG and PacifiCorp to submit proposals for energy storage projects by January 1st, 2018 that are in accordance with those guidelines that were set up in the first phase. The proposals would include more technical detail and analysis about the value of energy storage to the electric system and operations that is currently required in the IRPs. In addition, the proposals would have technical descriptions, expected costs, projected benefits of the projects that they're proposing. The third phase would require the commission to consider the proposals and balance the potential values to ratepayers and utility operations, and then the costs to construct, operate, and maintain energy storage projects. After considering the proposal, the commission may authorize one or more of the projects as what we called in the bill, qualifying energy storage projects. And then the final and fourth phase would come about only if there had been authorization in the third phase. Once a proposed project is authorized as qualifying, competitive bidding would be used to develop a project to help fulfill energy storage targets for each of the utilities. Each utility's target is, by 2020, to procure energy storage capacity that's at least 5 megawatts and up to 1% of their 2014 peak load. So as an example, 1% of 2014 peak load for PGE would be 38.66 megawatts and a little less than that for PacifiCorp. I wanted to note that if no projects are authorized by the commission in phase three, say because perhaps it's too costly, then the utility's energy storage targets would not be in effect. And that we would have learned a lot from the process, though. So thank you. If you have any questions, we'd be happy to answer them, or I could pass it over to PNNL. Pass it over.
Any questions?
Yeah, thank you.
Nope.
Actually, sorry, Mr. Chair. I guess real quickly, I'm just going through this. So energy storage, it could be hydro, it could be lots of different things is what I'm seeing with the amendments. So this is a lot different than what I planned on. So hydro system actually could be something that you would consider for energy storage.
Vice Chairs Reardon and Johnson, members of, Representative Widener. Yes, there is. Yes, the answer is yes. The qualification of that is depending upon the size. So a large pumped hydro storage system could be really, really big and would not fall under this the range here. But if there are smaller, I'm actually not even sure if there are smaller pumped hydros of this size. Maybe there are. But if there are, then they would fit. There's no distinction in technology type. There's a distinction in size.
May I follow up? So something that might be appropriate is taking off the cap on the high side and just leaving it must achieve a minimum, but not put a cap on what they can do.
Representative Whitehead, that's a possibility that lifts the... That was one of the, I suppose, ratepayer protections is to sort of create a cap beyond which, I mean, the core ratepayer protection is the Public Utility Commission doing their cost-benefit analysis and determining, actually, they're the gatekeeper to determine if a project will go forward or not. I think the cap was an additional security blanket measure.
Representative Bentz.
Thank you, and you may get this get to this in any event, but I was just looking at the amendment to the dash one. I was looking at page 2, lines 12 through 15, 14, and it says reasonably balances the potential values derived from the energy storage systems to ratepayers and operations and the costs necessary to construct and so forth and so on. So I'm just curious, because in past meetings we've looked at the balancing of our systems with water. So that's how, I think that's how it's worked to this point. Is it, and I had understood that we are reaching a point where we are running out of the ability to balance with the water that BPA has. And I don't know what we use for balancing that, I guess natural gas. But since we've had, since we've enjoyed that opportunity, is it now more likely that we've reached a point where this type of storage is more likely to fit that or to lend itself to a reasonable balance?
Vice Chairs Reardon and Johnson, Representative Bentz, I think when the next speaker can actually address some of that, I'm hoping, that's really one of the aspects of energy storage that is exciting. If to the extent that the hydro system is reaching its capacity to integrate variable energy resources, energy storage is one of those technologies and one of those tools that can take us the next generation.
I'm going to follow up, Mr. Chair.
Absolutely.
So if the, so is reaching it, are we there yet? Have we, I know on occasion way too much wind power, on occasion way too much water power, but that's on occasion. Are we to a point where we need this kind of storage? That's the question.
So, Representative Bentz, I think one, if you were to ask Bonneville Power Administration, they would, I tell you, on an average basis, they're coming close to reaching the limit of their ability to integrate more and more renewables. On an hour-to-hour basis, there's still always that ability. So it's a sort of a more complicated answer. I think they're feeling stretched. But again, on a sort of an hour-to-hour, real-time basis, there's still abilities of the hydro system.
And I'll just add that your question is really well-suited to phase two, because one of the things that the utilities will be asked to do is provide their operational data and where in their, do an analysis of where in their system there could be benefits like what you're suggesting. But it's really hard to do without that technical information that we don't always look at in the IRP.
Follow up. What I'm really trying to get at here is how soon is the need upon us, and in what volume, how much storage do we, is it, because I mean we could go all around on this, and I'm sure that's why you've set it up the way you have, but I'm just curious how close to this being something you might have brought up on your own before this bill. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm really asking.
Mm-hmm. So, Representative Bentz, that's an excellent question, and there's a couple of answers. One answer is I think this bill actually forces us to be able to answer your question better. Yeah. I'm not sure we can answer it right now. Another aspect of it, though, is that I think there would be parties who would suggest that the IRP, as good as it is in Oregon, some of the modeling doesn't actually capture some of the sub-hourly benefits that energy can provide. And so until we sit down and try to figure out really what some of the benefits of energy can be, I would give you a less than great answer. I think this bill helps us get to a better answer.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. So, Jason, I guess my question would perhaps be in line with Representative Bentz's, but what factors are there that are actually putting roadblocks or disincentives in the marketplace so that this isn't just happening on its own? Is it cost? Is it technology? Is it both? Because we've heard that PGE is already doing some some experimental stuff with battery storage, but it doesn't seem to be widely utilized at this point in time. So in your estimation, what are the barriers that are preventing this from happening in the marketplace?
Vice Chair Johnson, I would list a couple of things. Cost is an important element of it. A number of these technologies are still expensive, but the other part of it is perhaps we're not fully valuing the benefits of energy storage currently in the way we look at the system. So that has been an argument, is that we don't fully value all of the benefits that energy storage could provide to the system. And so if you combine that we're not looking at the full range of benefits and the technologies are still pretty expensive, or some of them, that generally means they wouldn't pass the cost benefit test. This helps us, and it helps the utilities begin to unravel some of that. And it may be that we find in one direction or the other. I'm actually not presupposing one outcome or another, but it does force us to concentrate on it. It forces the investor-owned utilities to concentrate on it. And again, hopefully we become here in a couple of years and be able to answer some of these questions with a lot more accuracy.
Just a couple of questions. I'm not really ever sure. What can you do with 5 megawatts? Is that significant, or is that like a model size? Is it?
Vice Chair Reardon, it's when you compare the RFI in California, they're looking at hundreds of megawatts, and clearly we weren't suggesting that we go to that direction. But you can learn a lot. A utility can look at its system and find out where some constraints are, where some interesting needs are, and with 5 megawatts, I think you can learn quite a bit. So this, I would consider this sort of a first stage in learning about the values and benefits of energy storage.
You mentioned PGE's plant here in Salem, which is basically a bunch of batteries, and so we're already learning from that, right?
That's correct.
Do you see maybe you'd be looking at proposals of other technologies so we can explore those, or what were you hoping to see?
Vice Chair Reardon, exactly. It's really asking the utilities to look into their system, finding where those opportunities are, trying to match those opportunities up with the right technology, and then coming forward with the information to the commission.
Okay, so the last question is, we're always trying to find ways to pay for these explorations. Remind me on the process that you go through, the utilities, is kind of a recovery process. So don't they front the money for this sort of thing or for any work that they do, and then they get to recover that in their rates based on a previous year? Is that roughly it?
Vice Chair Reardon, that's pretty close. I mean, if we go through this process, and the commission is really finding that they've met the terms of the statute and it's in the public interest, it certainly gives the utility a pretty high degree of assurance that they're going to get cost recovery when they come in during rate case time.
Would it be fair to say they're floating along to do this work?
Vice Chair Reardon, that's generally the way rate making works. Is they, in fact, state law prohibits a utility from recovering costs of a resource that is not currently operating, and so they have to make the investment first, and they get cost recovery later.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Oops.
If I can follow up on your question.
Yes.
Thank you. So that gets us back to my original question, which was the reasonable measure of why we're engaged in this. If natural gas prices go to 3 cents, then would storage ever make sense? That's a nice way of putting it, don't you think? So seriously, is that how you would run these numbers? I mean, I'm just asking, why bother to store it if we can get it so inexpensively? Mm-hmm. Is that the type of measure that you'll be putting into place, or could you even do anything without this bill, because it would be so unlikely that storage would ever reach that kind of a low cost?
Representative Benson, you're asking excellent questions that I can't fully answer right now. So clearly we would be looking at avoided costs, but also clearly we would be looking at the amount of variable energy resources that are on the system now and will be on the system as a result of the renewable portfolio standard. So as we get more renewable resources that are variable, and non-dispatchable. To the extent that the commission is finding that there's a value to energy storage to help integrate that, it will be valuable. I won't say no matter what the avoided gas price is, but there are clearly values built into energy storage to help integrate the wind and solar that's coming anyway, no matter what the avoided cost is.
Okay. Thank you.
And I would expect that our friends from the utilities can also follow up on that question as well. So we have Patrick. You're up.
Yes, thank you for inviting me to speak today. Vice Chairs Reardon, Johnson, and members of the committee, my name is Patrick Balducci. I'm a senior economist at the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory. I'm also the manager of the technical activities in support of the Washington Clean Energy Fund work that we're doing in Washington State. The Pacific Northwest National Laboratory, for those of you who are unfamiliar with us, is a U.S. Department of Energy lab managed by the Battelle Memorial Institute. The interdisciplinary teams at PNNL address some pressing research issues around energy, environment, and national security. Through advances in basic and applied sciences. We were founded in 1965, and we have 4,300 staff, nearly 4,000 of which are located in the Tri-Cities area of Washington State. We do have a presence in Portland, Oregon. We're currently engaged in research designed to improve the efficiency of energy storage technologies and enhance the results achieved from them following deployment. And one such engagement is with the Washington Clean Energy Fund, which is a program with some similarities to the one being proposed here today. The Washington Clean Energy Fund supports the development, demonstration, and deployment of clean energy technologies that save energy and reduce costs, reduce harmful air emissions, or otherwise increase energy independence for the state. Washington CEF has awarded $14.3 million in support of energy storage projects in Washington State. There's five projects overall with three utilities, Snohomish PUD, Avista, and Puget Sound Energy. And collectively, it's about 7 megawatts of power capacity. To answer your question, in California, it's 1.325 gigawatts of energy storage capacity by 2020, so a significant jump. It's very different between Washington State, which is more of a pilot basis, in California, where if you've ever seen the California duck curve, there's significant concerns about the midday dip in load, and then the fast ramping requirements in the afternoon. That is to say, if solar is generating significant capacity in midday and then comes offline during the evening peak, that is a grave concern in California. And so the mandate there is more of an action plan as opposed to a pilot test. So to support these projects, we've developed use cases or the services that can ultimately be provided by the energy storage systems, and we are conducting benefits analysis of each of those systems, compiling field test data needed for the use case testing, and we're helping the utilities and regulators understand the long-term benefits of the new technologies, and we're designing plans for acceptance testing, and we're actually strengthening the control strategies as well. So we have developed a suite of analytical tools for performing this sort of work, and if you look at your handouts, I don't know if you all have your handouts in front of you, but effectively there are a variety of services that can be provided by an energy storage system, and historically energy storage has been undervalued either from a regulatory perspective or from an understanding perspective. At any given time, they could be buying low and selling high in the energy market, which is called arbitrage. You could be balancing, so helping with the integration of renewables. You could be using it to shave peaks, which helps in terms of both capacity and deferring investments in distribution infrastructure. And then it can also be used locally to mitigate outages. And so we're designing methods to understand the system requirements and the financial benefits associated with each of those services. And what you see with this first handout is that given the conditions on the system and the energy prices, you can effectively bundle the services. So In the second bar, you see that we're providing arbitrage only. But if the balancing up or down price was sufficient to warrant moving into that market, that could be done, and then you deviate from the initial schedule. Point is, as the different services are layered one on top of the other, during any day, you would actually bounce between them, optimizing the performance of the energy storage system and then maximizing the value derived from the provision of those services. We use this model, which we call the battery storage evaluation tool, to investigate the benefits and compare them to the revenue requirements for an energy storage system designed by Primus Energy, located in the Bay Area, as deployed on Bainbridge Island. In Puget Sound. Bainbridge Island has a feeder coming in from the north. There are three substations located on that island. Bainbridge Island's in Puget Sound, 25-minute ferry ride from Seattle. It is capacity constrained with respect to the substations, and the local citizens are not eager to for an investment in expansion of distribution infrastructure on the island, including potentially additional substations, additional transmission and distribution capacity, which would result in the redevelopment of a lot of land for utility assets. And so Puget Sound Energy was interested in exploring energy storage on the island to defer this investment and find ways to satisfy both the local citizens and the system needs. So we examined a 4-megawatt, 16-megawatt-hour system located on Bainbridge Island. We used local system data and information, modeled the system, modeled the energy storage power and energy capacities over a year's time, on an hourly basis, balancing on a minute-by-minute basis. And if you flip over that piece of paper, you'll see the outcome of the analysis. We explored four scenarios. In all four cases, the benefits derived from the system exceeded the revenue requirements for that system. And you can see an actual image of one of the Primus Energy pods there. So the results in this case were promising, with system benefits over an expected 20-year time horizon, estimated at $26.6 million, and that's in present value terms. And that resulted in a 1.32 return on investment ratio with net benefits of approximately $6.5 million. So in that case, with the locational benefits, particularly outage mitigation, they had significant outages there. I can tell you Puget Sound Energy now is also investigating energy storage as part of the Washington Clean Energy Fund work near a location near a town called Glacier, where they're experiencing significant outages. And so you don't have to be on an island to experience the benefits of energy storage. This is a long rural feeder where there are significant reliability problems. So energy storage can be used for reliability in rural locations as well. So, you know, what we're finding is that energy storage systems do have the potential to improve operating capabilities of the electric grid. And their ability to store energy and deliver power can increase the flexibility of grid operations while providing the reliability and robustness that will be necessary in the grid of the future. However, the technologies, while showing promise, need further development to address performance, cost, and durability barriers. Thank you once again for the opportunity to provide testimony to the committee. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Well, thank you very much. And by the way, thank you for making the long drive over today. That's quite a trip.
Well, I will say that I'm located in our Portland office, okay. So it wasn't too long.
Never mind. If you go to the home office, it's
okay.
In Hanford area, right?
Yeah, that's right. Richland, Washington, where I toiled for 3 years until they allowed me to move to Portland. So,
any questions? Rep. Holby.
Thanks for coming all the way from Portland. I do appreciate it, and I wished I totally understood everything you just said. But, you know, from what I'm sitting here listening to you, you're kind of telling us about a lot of the other types of benefits that energy storage have when you spoke about resiliency and security and, you know, those sorts of attributes to ensuring that the grid has some reliability. And though we, I'm curious, though, as far as, you know, getting these projects off the ground and funding, I know we have the PGE did their project here with ARRA funds, I believe. Mm-hmm. And so what kind of funds do you find out there for energy storage projects? You know, as we're looking and talking to the PUC about, you know, the utilities bringing in you know, an investment in doing cost recovery, you know, through the ratepayers. Are there other sources of funds out there that could make it more attractive for Oregon to go down this pathway?
Vice Chairs Reardon and Johnson, Representative Holvey, that's an excellent question. And yes, there are a number of sources of research funds and also funds required for the investment. So, for example, with the Washington Clean Energy Fund work, and also I'll back up for a second, the Bainbridge Island work was done as part of the Bonneville Power Administration Technology Innovation Program. And then the U.S. Department of Energy provided a 50% cost share for all of our analytical work. So the energy storage program at the U.S. Department of Energy provide 50% cost share. And then the utility and the technology provider, in this case Primus and Puget Sound Energy, also provided at least a 50% cost share. There are several other areas of opportunity here in terms of bringing in utility funding. Washington Clean Energy Fund is a 50% cost share for us. U.S. Department of Energy, you know, match the dollars one for one for all of our research. And so we've seen several sources of funding from BPA, from federal U.S. DOE, from utilities, and then ultimately from the Washington State Department of Commerce as well on the projects that we're working on presently.
So the Washington Clean Energy Fund, is that state funds?
That's correct. Vice Chair Reardon, it's $14.3 million being provided to these energy storage projects. It's a total investment of $43 million. So I believe utilities are providing the balance, the difference between those two amounts. Our research contracts on this are $1.68 million, half of which is being provided by the U.S. Department of Energy. So the U.S. Department of Energy is very eager about cost sharing. They're as interested in leveraging research funds as the states are. And so you can leverage it in both directions, I suppose. And that's the model that we've been using.
Representative Mintz.
Mr. Chair, so would it be your opinion that if we're going to have a green power future, we have to have storage?
So, Vice Chairs Reardon and Johnson, Representative Bentz, Battelle is a 501c3, and the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory is a federal entity, and as such, we don't provide advice or opinions regarding these matters or advocate for one position or another.
Yes. I wasn't as much asking for your opinion as let me put it a different way. So there's all kinds of ways we don't have to have storage. We could put a wire clear around the other side of the world and use their power when the sun is on that side, and they could use ours and vice versa. So we wouldn't need storage, right? Or we could use natural gas, to which we're doing now to mm-hmm. balance these systems. Mm-hmm. But my question to you is, maybe better framed, mm-hmm. is there a economically decent way, manageable way, reasonable way, there's the word, mm-hmm. For us to use these batteries or storage technologies, and given the work you've done so far, mm-hmm. that in any way matches the low cost of natural gas?
Okay, now that's Vice Chairs Reardon Johnson, Representative Bentz, that's an excellent question, and one I'm happy to answer. So there are all these alternatives, right? You could use combustion turbines, pumped hydro, flywheels, various battery chemistries. We performed an evaluation, what we called the National Energy Storage Evaluation. We assumed a 20% RPS scenario nationwide. We then placed wind across the U.S. and then evaluated 9 competing technologies for balancing the grid in response to the variability caused by those high integration, the high renewables integration scenarios. And what we found is that presently the three energy battery storage technologies that we evaluated, that was redox flow batteries, sodium sulfur batteries, and lithium ion batteries, were not cost competitive with traditional combustion turbines. However, by 2020, we were forecasting price reductions that would yield cost competitiveness. And in each case, I believe they were not only cost competitive, but more beneficial to the grid when compared to combustion turbines, particularly sodium sulfur batteries. They were the winning technology among the nine that we evaluated. So presently, it's more locational. It's more situational because it can be distributed. It can be placed on an island. And, of course, there are no emissions associated with an energy storage technology. And so there are some real – they're quicker in terms of their ramping capabilities. And so there's some real current benefits for energy storage, but it's a locational basis. We've had some analyses that certainly didn't turn out that the benefits exceeded the costs associated with the system. We've had some that do. It depends on the situation and the location. But we are forecasting by 2020 that energy storage will be more cost competitive. But between now and then, you have to work through several issues with respect to how you would integrate it, how you can optimize the performance. Is there an architecture for integrating it? Is there an industry with the capacity to produce the batteries required for the need? And that's where work is needed between now and that future day.
You mentioned the vast size of California's storage, and have you done enough modeling to know how much Oregon would need potentially, say 2020, for example?
Right, that's an excellent question, Vice Chair Reardon. We did perform these analyses on a regional basis for just balancing wind, so that's just one service that we're targeting there. I don't have that number off the top of my head. We had it covered for the entirety of the Northwest Power Pool, so I don't know if we had data specific to Oregon. Once again, a huge program in California, only 7 megawatts in Washington to work through some of these issues. But no, I don't have the answer to that question.
Do you know the percentage of power supplied in California that's produced by renewables? I know we're like 8%, something like that. Again, I think California's is a little larger.
Right. Vice Chair Reardon, I don't know what it is. Currently, I know that the RPS in California is 33%. So they're experiencing significant growth in California currently.
33% by when?
It's either... Vice Chair Reardon, I think it's either 2020 or 2025. Okay. So I know their energy storage program does plan to bring on the 1.3 gigawatts by 2020, 1.325 gigawatts by 2020. Okay. And that's just three utilities there that are providing the bulk of the energy storage capacity.
Great. Any other questions? Rep. Holby.
Thanks. Is it fair to say that this proposal sort of sets guidelines and helps establish, you know, the pathway for pilot projects to get established to move us towards that 2020 time frame?
Well, I don't know. Vice Chairs Reardon and Johnson, Representative Holden.
Can't answer that question.
Well, we have to be careful. We're just brokers of information. But I don't know if that's the goal of that bill. I mean, that would be for my colleagues here to answer, I suppose. But I know in Washington State, I mean, I believe that's the goal, is to remove some of these barriers. For example, I mean, one part of the project I didn't even mention is that we're working with Avista Utilities out of Spokane to develop an optimizer. So just the idea of taking an energy storage system and then bringing it on to your electric grid. I mean, the concerns that planners have around a new asset that may be providing a backflow of energy to mitigate an outage, for example, How do you integrate that with existing infrastructure? That's a real question and concern from Avista's perspective. So we're working with Washington State University and Avista to do just that, and that is to develop an optimizer, so a way to control the energy storage system remotely in an automated manner, in such a way that you don't damage the infrastructure and you derive the maximum amount of benefits from it. There's no off-the-shelf, you know, optimizer for that sort of problem. On Snohomish PUD side, they're really interested in what's called the MESA architecture. When energy storage systems are being deployed, it's really being deployed in kind of a one-off manner. So there's no architecture or framework on how to do it exactly, to do it precisely and do it correctly. And so they're working on that. So, you know, assuming the program here in Oregon was similar to the program in Washington, then, you know, those sorts of goals would be key towards finding success. I'll tell you, in addition, there's 5 energy storage systems being provided, and 2 are from a company that spun off of Pacific Northwest National Laboratory, Uni Energy Technologies. So they're also advancing a energy storage industry in the state. They're developing vanadium redox, vanadium flow batteries, and they're providing these multi-million dollar, very advanced systems to Avista and to Snohomish PUD. So that's what they're doing in Washington. Similar sorts of objectives, I would presume, could be achieved here in Oregon.
Thanks.
Thank you. Appreciate what you're doing. And I had a chance to, I think with Representative Reardon, actually, to tour your lab this summer. It's an amazing complex. But it sounds like you mentioned several Washington utilities, and you talk about California, but I'm guessing that some of our other Oregon-based utilities also interact with you on occasion just to kind of learn what you're learning and to have the benefit of your research as you move forward on this kind of technology, on smart grid technology, which we saw and we were up there, too. So that's correct, is it not?
Vice Chair Johnson, that's absolutely correct.
Great, thank you.
Okay, well, thank you all for coming today. This has been very enlightening, very helpful.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And let's see. Get John Fernandez, Hillary Barber. And I think, was that Dina? Dina Kelly?
Am I okay?
Not too close, about like that.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Representative Reardon, Vice Chair Johnson, members of the committee. Good afternoon. My name is John Fernandez. I am the Policy and Market Development Manager for Res Americas out of Broomfield, Colorado. We are a renewable energy, electric transmission, and energy storage development and construction company. We have operational storage facilities in both the U.S. and Canada, and are currently constructing the Glacier, Washington project that was referenced earlier. And just to cover a quick previous question, Representative Holvey, we do have fully automated control mechanisms for our storage resources. I'm here today speaking on behalf of our industry trade group, ESA, the Energy Storage Association. ESA, of course, would like to applaud the committee for presenting a bill like this, but I think more importantly, we want to recognize the comprehensive list of services that storage can provide that were recognized in this bill. Frequently at the introduction of proposals like this, storage is only referenced as an arbitrage resource or perhaps a load shifting resource. So this committee obviously did its homework when it comes to this bill. It's very good. We just have really three key thoughts we'd like to share with the committee today. First of all, when it comes to energy storage projects, the bill references power, 5 kilowatt or 5 megawatt systems. With energy storage, there is also a duration component. In terms of megawatt hours, the costs of these facilities are typically dollars per megawatt per cycle is how they're presented. So that's just something to keep in mind for all stakeholders moving forward. It could be some very different units as far as how traditional resources are captured. Second, and it was brought up earlier, excuse me, I believe by Representative Widener, the 1% cap. ESA would like stakeholders to give some extra consideration to that. It appears that protections for ratepayers are built in to this proposal. Any storage project that is approved to move forward has to be cost-effective for ratepayers. There is a risk with any cap to a program like this. The utilities may find that a larger facility provides a specific service that they are looking for, reserve requirements, or maybe there could be a large fleet of smaller resources that could address grid congestion. And if the full project portfolio bumps up against that cap, ratepayers might not realize the full benefit. So something to consider. And then finally, ESA fully supports newcomers to the industry, driving technical innovation, driving costs down. There is a risk with open solicitation such as this where newcomers that aren't as experienced developing projects, they'll bring their product, they'll bring their service to the market at cost just to help get their business going, and then they provide what historically have been shown to be low estimates of the full project deployment. This can lead to incomplete projects, inaccurate projects, cost overruns. So we'd like the committee to consider some sort of mechanism that might mitigate against that, be it any proposal coming to the table needs to be backed by an experienced storage development or construction company or an experienced financial lending institution. Another means to address this, if the utilities are amenable to it, is third-party review. And this should be third parties, again, that are experienced in storage. This is not solar. These are not traditional utility substations. And so this third party would be able to look and say, yes, this is a realistic proposal. This proposal is both technically and financially viable. So those are the three key points we wanted to leave with you today. Otherwise, obviously, we're very excited. What we would really ultimately like to see, and this has been mentioned already, is storage to become part of the standard utility resource planning process. We believe that storage is competitive right now. This question has been raised several times. Res Americas has merchant storage operating in U.S. markets right now. No grants, no loans, no funny tax breaks. Business model was written up, and we accept the commercial risk for it. State of California has energy storage in its resource adequacy construct because it's economical. It is a good reliability resource. And we certainly hope that the utilities will be afforded the means to get the appropriate cost recovery for this as well. So thank you very much for your time. I welcome any questions, including ones that have already been asked. I can certainly answer what I can.
Thank you very much. Hurry, how are you doing?
I'm sorry.
Good afternoon, Vice Chair Reardon and Vice Chair Johnson, members of the committee. Thank you. For the record, my name is Hillary Barber, and I'm the Policy Director for Renewable Northwest. And I'm joined today by my colleague, Dina Dubson Kelly, from Renewable Northwest as well. Dina manages our storage subgroup. I will be delivering the testimony on behalf of Renewable Northwest, and if there are questions, it may be more appropriate for Dina to answer. She's here to help with that. So Renewable Northwest is pleased to support HB 2193 and the Dash 1 amendment. We see this bill as a tool to help accelerate the acquisition of energy storage systems here in Oregon. We've already talked a great deal about the benefits that storage brings, and I'm not going to repeat everything that's already been said, but I do want to underscore how much storage can help, both with the integration of more renewables onto the grid, but also to unlock the even greater value that renewable resources bring to utilities, to customers, those benefits. Storage is definitely a key to unlocking those benefits. We've already talked about decreased carbon emissions, a more secure and efficient grid, and we are pleased that advances in technology mean that storage is becoming more cost effective, and it was interesting to hear PNNL talk about their analysis and looking at 2020 as a point where storage is in fact beating out other technologies. So we're excited to be following that work. We've seen other states prompt storage procurement, and we're excited that Oregon could be doing that with this bill as well. We think this bill sends an appropriate signal. We're pleased that it's technology neutral, that it provides rate recovery and for the utilities, and that it also protects the public interest. It's great to see PGE has already taken steps in this direction, and we applaud their leadership. And we look forward to seeing this bill move forward to prompt that next step in storage procurement and development. So with that, I'm going to close, and we'll be happy to answer any questions the committee may have.
Well, we can just go back to the whole group, I guess. Nina, are you speaking, or are you just...
Thank you, Vice Chair Reardon, Vice Chair Johnson, members of the committee. This is Dina Dubson-Kelly with Renewable Northwest. I think since Representative Bentz is back, I'll just take a moment and try to address a couple of his questions earlier. First, about the Bonneville hydro system and its ability to integrate. I do a lot of work in that space as well, and my understanding is Bonneville is running up against its own ability to provide reserves for integrating resources on its system and has undertaken a process to try to procure reserves from third parties in the market. In one of its RFPs, demand response actually came out as a winner, came out to be the most cost-effective resource and is providing some of those third-party balancing reserves. So that is to say that we are sort of getting close to the edge of the amount of reserves that Bonneville can provide. And while we think that there are other ways that we can achieve greater flexibility within the existing system, some examples of that would be 15-minute scheduling and energy imbalance markets, we don't want to wait until we get to the point that we're completely tapped out to start looking at other alternatives such as energy storage. And so it seems like now is a really good time to start doing research into that kind of work, those technologies, and try to gain experience with it, figure out what the right approach is for Oregon, and not wait until we're at the point where we're out and then we really are going to get gouged if we're looking on the market. So start that work early and often. And in terms of what if natural gas is really cheap, I just would say that, you know, a lot of models right now show that natural gas is expected to be cheap for some amount of time, but we've heard that story before, and we've seen the price fluctuate significantly, and so we also wouldn't want to rely on that. And as the gentleman from PNNL referenced earlier, there's other benefits besides integration of renewables that storage can provide, and so avoidance of transmission and distribution build-out, that's something that would be important value storage could provide regardless of what natural gas prices are, because transmission is very expensive. So that's it from me, unless there are further questions. Thank you.
Anything else? Thank you all for coming.
Thank
I appreciate
you.
It.
Question before they leave?
Mm-hmm. Sorry.
I was really curious about your analysis of the cap, and you know how that may be a constraint at some point. And so trying to figure out how to deal with that, the cap sort of put in there to help protect consumers. So you know, what's been your experience in, I guess, raising that cap, or to, you know, what level do you raise it, or do you propose just eliminating it? And if you do, how do you provide that consumer protection piece?
I think focusing very closely on the cost benefit to consumer, and perhaps lining up a specific storage deployment against what would be the non-storage solution in a certain instance. So if it were reserve requirements, this is where the conversation about natural gas would come in. Of course, natural gas is cheap, but if it's especially peak capacity needs, peak reserve needs, typically you find that those needs are very limited frequency per year and very limited in duration. And in that instance, it might not justify building a new gas plant. It doesn't necessarily justify keeping an old fossil plant online just in the interest of providing that service, where a more limited duration storage facility that is not just going to sit for the days it's not providing that peak service, but it can balance congestions, absorb overload during for intermittence. excuse me, provide other balancing services to the balancing authority, I think that's when you start to see those benefits line up. Excuse me. And I don't, again, I think that's where you would see, you would mitigate the need to cap how big that system could be. Just size the system to the need, take a look at what the alternative cost would be, and then just find the best solution for ratepayers.
Yeah. Vice Chairs Reardon and Johnson, Representative Holdy, I would just add that I think we have great faith in the PUC process and the wonderful ratepayer advocates that we have in the state of Oregon, that throughout that process, we think they'll ensure that the ratepayers are protected, and so that might eliminate the need for this cap type approach. Just deal with it there.
Thanks. Representative Benz. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess you guys that do this all the time, you'll forgive the I don't have the right words for this, but the cost of green power has, in some senses, the intermittent nature of it has been absorbed by the fact that we had BPA. That when we exhaust that storage device that we now have, we've got to get another one. How do we take into account that additional cost that the intermittent nature of the green power presents, whether it's solar or whether it's wind? Am I guessing that it was taken into account as the contracts for that resource were let, and now as the storage comes on, do they get another bill, or what happens? I'm just curious. Who pays for this storage that's necessitated by green power?
Representative Reardon and Johnson, Vice Chairs Reardon and Johnson, Representative Benz. Again, we would just point to all the many benefits that storage can provide. We don't think it's necessarily unique to renewables. Storage has a lot of benefits to the system, and so, you know, to look at it from a system perspective, and I think the PUC process is anticipated to do that and figure out how to assess those values and costs and how to allocate them appropriately. But renewables currently do pay significant integration charges, particularly in the Northwest, especially compared to parts of the country where they have more advanced markets, such as, you know, California EIM, energy imbalance market. So those costs are already included in the costs that renewable projects pay.
Thank you.
Okay, I think we've exhausted the questions, so thank you.
Thank you.
And up next we have Sean Miller and Warner Seaman. Whoever would like to go first.
All right.
Thank you very much for coming out.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Sean Miller. I'm here today on behalf of PacifiCorp, which is an investor-owned utility serving more than 560,000 customers, predominantly in rural Oregon, as Pacific Power. The company supports new energy technology developments, including energy storage technologies. So the company appreciates the interest and benefits in the technology that Representative Holy brings to the bill. PacifiCorp regularly conducts analysis on the potential use and applications of energy storage technology. This analysis is within our Integrated Resource Plan, or IRP, which you heard discussion on the last panel with the Public Utility Commission. While it is not currently economic for the company to procure energy storage, we continue to conduct analysis on energy storage and look for ways to improve our system to maximize benefits to our customers in the most cost-effective manner. PacifiCorp is concerned with the legislation as drafted, along with the -1 amendments. Our current analysis of storage technology shows that it is not cost-effective technology for us to pursue. You know, at this time, we cannot support a mandate for utilities to submit a proposal for storage procurement. We appreciate the cost recovery language and the regulatory certainty of the bill, but still concerned that the language creates this risk for our customers to pay above market prices for procurement of this technology. You know, again, if cost-effective energy storage becomes available, we will pursue it, as it will be in the best interest of our customers. We also cannot support a mandate that only applies to just three utilities. So a lot of the discussion I heard on BPA earlier doesn't really pertain to us, because it's only on the investor-owned utilities. Mm-hmm. However, the company would be interested in a general investigation into utility energy storage, and particularly how it could benefit utilities within an RPS compliance obligation in Oregon. Currently, energy storage is not an Oregon qualifying resource, but if it became an eligible technology, that could change the economic feasibility. We understand the need to think creatively about energy storage as more renewables come online or are integrated into the grid, and so we want to maximize our efficiency of our system. So energy storage will be a mechanism to create these efficiencies when the technology is available. And so in summary, again, when it is this technology is available, you know, we are just excited about the advocates utilizing this technology, and so in a cost-effective manner for our customers. And so, you know, with that, I will conclude my remarks. I heard that Washington was mentioned, and there was some legislation passed in Washington that that said that we had to consider looking at this in our integrated resource plans in the state of Washington. It was not a procurement mandate at that time, but again, we're going to be constantly looking at that in our IRPs, and again appreciate the discussion over this technology, because again, we are just excited as the advocates of the benefits of this technology. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'll conclude my remarks. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Seaman.
Chair Reardon, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Varner Seaman, representing Portland General Electric. I won't go over again the 5-megawatt test facility that we have here in Salem. People have talked about it already and some of the financing that went into that project. One of the things that had a conversation earlier this week with Representative Vega Peterson, and we do think that it may be worthwhile for the committee to take a field trip to look at that facility and to understand that operation a little bit, if folks think that's a good use of their time. One of the other things that we're looking at as a utility in the field of energy storage is actually trying to change some of the standards for at the federal level as part of our federal advocacy around how some of the controls on electric water heaters are packaged and sold. And one of the things that Bonneville's talked about for a number of years is using water heaters as a way to deal with variability of generation and demand in the system, essentially when there are times that we're long on energy, using those water heaters and then doing some electronically controlled dispatch to not have people heat up their water heater tanks at times when we're a little bit short on power in the system. This is still very much R&D. It's a ways out. But it's an example that I think is worth talking about in terms of sort of the wide array of things that can count as storage. When California started to do their work on the storage mandate they have in California, they came up with a pretty wide array of different technologies, and I think some folks here have talked about it, that can count as storage. I think people often think of batteries. That's certainly a form. As people have talked about here today, the water behind the dams in the in anyone's system where you've got a reservoir behind a dam effectively is storage. It's potential energy that you're holding back to be used at a later point in time. At this point, and I think to reiterate what Sean was saying, I mean, when we look at that use of the federal system or the Bonneville system for the integration of renewables, again, that's not something that's available to us by and large as investor-owned utilities. We, you know, we have to own and build our own generating resources. At this time, we share some of the concerns that PacifiCorp has, particularly that this isn't a statewide bill, that it's an investor-owned utility bill. The non-IOUs are also subject to the renewable portfolio standard, and we think that, you know, that's something that's worth considering. Not just in this policy, but as we look at all policies in the state, looking at having statewide energy policy as opposed to investor-owned utility energy policy and the non-investor-owned utility policy. There are some provisions in the bill around information sharing that, since we are doing some R&D, there are some things we'd like to keep proprietary. I think that's something that has caused a little bit of concern as we look at this this proposed legislation. And I think there's another concept that
is an interesting one to explore in energy storage, that when we talk about megawatts of capacity of batteries, there's sort of a different factor to look at, which is the amount of discharge of energy out of it. So it's sort of megawatts times megawatt hours. And we think as we look at storage going forward, it's an interesting concept to draw in, which is the difference between, you know, if you had a battery that's a 5-megawatt battery, but it can discharge for 1 hour, you get 5 megawatt hours, as opposed to a battery that is a 6-hour discharge at 5 megawatts would be a 30 megawatt hour battery. So just an issue that we wanted to raise that was in the bill. Thank you. Happy to take any questions if you have any.
Questions? We do have questions.
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks to both of you. Werner, can you fill us in perhaps a little bit on what PGE may have learned from your five megawatt test facility? What kind of outcomes are you getting from this experiment that you're doing?
Well, Chair Reardon, Representative Johnson, we're still putting that together. We could have somebody come in and present on it. I'm not the most expert on it. I think generally what I understand we're seeing is some of the conclusions out of the battery test facility that we have and over energy storage overall is there's been a notion that people have had for a long time that you could take batteries or any other storage device, something that charges and then discharges, you could and you could use it as an arbitrage opportunity, basically taking big chunks of energy at one point in time and then shifting them to a different point in time. Largely, we're not seeing storage developing for that type of opportunity, that sort of shifting of loads in large scale, but more as short-term to deal with times where you've got problems of voltage support on lines, where you've got some sag in the voltage and you potentially trigger outages, that you can do short-acting injections of power onto the system to keep voltage up. Similarly, if you were to think about a solar array, I'm going to draw a quick picture on my notebook. If you were to look at a solar array that was putting out power over a 12-hour period of time, and it looked spiky, mm-hmm. kind of like this, because it was partly cloudy day, maybe something like today, that you could use the storage to even out the curve in that solar output. Sorry for the highly technical drawing. Nice. But largely, we're seeing storage for those types of applications, injection of VARs into the system, voltage support, ancillary services, largely, as opposed to necessarily those arbitrage opportunities. Mm-hmm. But I think that's consistent with what some of the other folks have said earlier today.
Oh, good.
Follow up, and Scott, you mentioned it, and I think, Marnie, you agreed that it's certainly in the industry's interest when the technology is affordable to be able to utilize it as readily as you can, because obviously it could potentially mean that you don't produce another production facility or bring online additional capacity, which would be in everybody's best interest. So as that technology evolves and as it gets to that point where it is cost effective, you'll certainly embrace it readily as quickly as you can, right?
Yep, Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, absolutely.
Thank you.
I was waiting for Representative Boone to ask you about is there a role that storage would play on, particularly on the coast, in terms of improving resiliency of the system? Have you been concerned about that, or should that be part of this discussion?
I asked him that in a private meeting.
Oh, well, could you maybe share what you guys talked about?
this is a long-standing question that I have for people in the interest of mine, too, of having storage. And I asked him about the wind storage, actually, I think the project that we all saw when we attended Lehigh, mm-hmm. and how that was going. So I think it was you. It could have been John.
Chair Reardon.
Somebody this week.
Chair Reardon, Representative Boone, we did have a conversation.
A memorable meeting.
Yeah,
yes,
I think, and again, I think that some of the concern with backup supply in sort of areas and outages, would be, again, what's the volume and what's the duration? And how big of a battery do you need to build for how long? So if you've got in the, you know, city of Cannon Beach, for instance, if you said that was maybe a 1 megawatt load and the power was out or the feeder line to that area was out for 12 hours, for people to operate normally at normal levels, you'd need 12 megawatt hours. Mm-hmm. And so I think that the question is, you know, for those types of resiliency applications, that would be, you know, potentially a pretty significant investment, you know, to get that 12 megawatt hour discharge. You know, if people were able to conserve pretty significantly and cut their usage, you know, by a quarter and just keep refrigerators running or something like that, clearly the resource would last longer.
Representative Holtby.
Thanks. Appreciate your comments on this bill. Appreciate your point of view as well about this. I was just sort of, you know, curious though, as you're looking at when the cost becomes, you know, affordable, you know, we'll invest in it, and it's sort of makes me ask the question, or how are we ever going to get there if we don't start down this pathway of looking at pilot projects and trying to, you know, get moving on some of these technologies in Oregon and dealing with, you know, some of the other I guess roadblocks that we face with this. And so, you know, you've made mention that, you know, you consider this in your integrated resource plan, and, you know, but I'm curious, does that integrated resource plan call for, you know, an investment to pursue this, or is it just a consideration out here that says, well, the technologies that are available aren't available to us that are cost effective, and that process doesn't go through the PUC? So I'm just seeing this a little bit, I guess, a different, you know, chicken and egg thing. You know, I'm kind of looking at this differently, is that, you know, come up with some proposals and see, you know, if the PUC agrees that it might be cost effective and you have cost recovery in the bill to address that, that it doesn't help the system. And I guess the idea of being, you know, to push back just a little bit, that it isn't statewide, it just applies to IOUs, I'm certainly sensitive to that. And that's certainly the way it appears. But I think without moving the IOUs this direction, we can never, you know, bring the consumer utilities into this discussion as well, with being able to access funds to help them as well with getting into this space. So I sort of see this as, you know, the potentially the beginning of getting the whole state plan, a whole state plan there, but without, you know, in any sort of investment going down this road, it makes it really difficult, notwithstanding the Salem project that you have. But I think part of this, in my mind, is that we really have to start planning for this. You know, we really have to start moving in this direction for 2020. You know, otherwise we're going to sit back and watch it happen around us and really be up against a brick wall at some point, going, you know, we don't have the capacity for storage that we really need right now, and resiliency will become a big issue on the coast and rural Oregon, or anywhere that you know, where we have reliability issues. So I just, you know, I want to partner with the IOUs in going down this direction. I just sense some resistance to, you know, really having a robust integrated resource plan that includes energy storage in it, and allowing the PUC to sort of be the gatekeeper of getting a couple of pilots going that will help us get there on a system-wide solution. I guess I took too long. So I'm not sure there was a question there, but you know,
just an observation, if I may. And I bet you're going to say the same thing. But aren't there's a lot of market activity out there that are developing these solutions now? At least mm-hmm. I saw it when I went to Lehigh. Mm-hmm. And your mind is younger than mine, and maybe you can remember some of them. But I just remember truckloads of battery systems and other things that were being developed, and so I don't think that things are not happening. I think there is a market that's, market forces are at work here. So, your comment.
Chair Reardon, Representative Holvey, first I was just going to thank Representative Holvey for acknowledging our, I wish E-Web was in the room to hear Representative Holvey talk about our leadership in the utility space. funny for me at least, so thank you on that. Yeah, I think there is a lot of R&D taking place. I think there's some interesting R&D taking place in Oregon. A personal friend of mine who I had lunch with a couple months ago is working on some really interesting technology in the battery space that hopefully cuts the cost. They model it out to be about a quarter of the cost of the current battery capacity. So I think there is some interesting R&D going on. I mean, I would, you know, to, and I think that Representative Holvey raises a strong point in terms of the need for some R&D on this, because I think there are sort of two halves of it, which is part of the reason why we're, you know, looking at it and why we've moved forward with the work that we've done so far and some of the other technologies we're exploring. There's both the technical engineering design on the systems themselves, the storage facilities, you know, again with pretty broad variety of different technologies that can act as storage facilities, and then there's the second part, which is how do you put it on the grid and how do you use it within the system. And so I think those points are well taken. I think that there's a lot of merit to the points.
Do you have people at PGE that work on these issues on a regular basis, on looking at new solutions or how to make your system better?
Representative Reardon, members of the committee, we have some people working on this facility. Generally speaking, R&D is less of a utility function, given some of the constraints of rate making that, as Mr. Eisdorf was talking about earlier, and I'm sure he could correct as I get this probably a little bit off, but we're not able to use ratepayer dollars for things outside of that which is used and useful. And so generally speaking, to acknowledge this bill would you know, give some additional discretion to the PUC to allow some work outside of the usual scope in a fairly defined context. But generally speaking, we're not able to do that R&D. You know, we're not able to use ratepayer dollars for science projects. It's maybe one kind of blunt way to put it.
Okay. Thought I saw a hand down this way. But
Hurd has first.
Representative Hurd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we talked earlier about if we don't invest, how do we get there? From a business standpoint, because I mean, I see the utility companies as trying to basically, your job and your opinion, and in mine as well, is to go out and shop for the lowest cost electricity to get to your ratepayers. Okay. As far as pushing the industry towards more affordable battery storage, essentially, I mean, a lot of us, I think, are thinking in terms of what a traditional battery would be as far as storing electricity. Obviously, you know, and several of us know that there's several other forms of storing electricity. But for me, I mean, there's companies like Tesla, BMW, I could go on and on and on, that are in the electric car industry where the heart and soul of what they are creating is battery-based. And so, to me, it seems like we're trying to force the issue onto our utility companies to create to invest in R&D in batteries when you already have another industry over here that's doing it for us. Within 5 to 10 years, and as we just keep advancing, the cost of these batteries are going to continue to be driven down just by the electric car market alone worldwide. The capacity, the amount of time they'll last, because that's a big concern always with batteries, is how long they'll actually last. So to me, I become weary of the mandates we keep putting on the private industries to keep doing all these R&D projects that we, the really, in my opinion, very uneducated in these industries, legislators keep forcing upon these professionals in these industries. So I'm just concerned that we're trying to make this group over here do their own thing while this group over here is doing the same thing already for us, and we're not having to pay for it. We can't, as a state, afford to lead the charge on everything involving the green industry. Sometimes it's better, in my opinion, just to sit back a little bit, wait for a half a decade, because we have consistent cheap energy available to us right now. Am I wrong? Okay. So while you have a consistent cheap energy source available to us, why go out prematurely from our investment standpoint and spend money that we may not be able to afford when somebody else is already doing it for us.
Okay. Any other questions, comments? Thank you. Oh, Representative Boone.
And thank you. And I'm glad that Representative Hurd went first because he sort of laid the groundwork for my comments. And that is the same idea in that sense that, you know, maybe what we should be mandated is that you guys toot your own horns a little louder. Let us know what you're doing, but so that we won't be creating more for you to do without acknowledging what you are doing. Mm. And this is a great time to bring up my standard comment about the community fund type idea, where it's an incentive-based program of people investing in their communities. And this is happening in Briar Island and outside of Halifax, Nova Scotia. And it's a small community-based program because it's a small community. There's not very many people there. But they invest in a fund that's can only be spent in their area on renewables in their area. 51% has to be owned by the people there, and the money stays there. It creates it. So they now are about at 100% renewables because of this, and their renewables are tidal and wind and solar and things like that that are, you know, cheap and free. Once the system's set up, it doesn't cost anything, and the money is just, it stays there. And so it's a good thing. And it's been competitive. And so like any competitive thing, there's a little fun and sport in it. It just is, I think, if we acknowledge what people are doing out there, because it's out there, and you're all invited to come up to my office and take a copy of Recharge News and see what's happening. So I'll quit there, but I think my point is made.
Anybody? Representative Hovey.
Thank you. I couldn't let the conversation continue to move. I did want to ask the PUC another question, if that would be okay to bring them back.
Yeah, bring them up.
All right. Thanks. We can excuse you, gentlemen. Thank you very much for coming in today.
Thank you. I've listened to this dialogue and about the, you know, the cost effectiveness and the technology isn't here. We shouldn't be investing in it, and other people are doing it, and maybe this is a mandate. So I'm kind of curious about when they talked about when the utilities talked about their integrated resource plan. Do they? Because they submit those to the PUC, and you review them. So, do they have proposals for energy storage that are the PUCs considering right now for the future?
Vice Chair Reardon, Vice Chair Johnson, Representative Hovey. Who's in front of us right now? I think PGE was the latest one. What we tend to do is have them, they do multiple scenarios and multiple runs. And so some of them will be more heavily advanced technology and others will be less so. I think it's fair to say that we haven't had an energy storage future be picked as the preferred approach. So in that sense, no, we're tending to get the preferred approach as sort of the standard set of resources. If I could, I would make one point based on the conversation that went before, which is I wouldn't see this bill as getting the utilities heavily invested in R&D. We're not this bill, and I'm pretty sure the commission would not look kindly on the utility going into the business of trying to figure out what a new, better battery is. This is really looking at the existing set of technologies that are out there and really beginning, frankly, the commission getting some practice and the utility getting some practice in figuring out how those existing technologies work with the electricity system and their system in particular.
A follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
And thank you. And currently, if a utility were to want to bring forward an energy storage project, would they be able to get cost recovery?
It depends. I think one of the whether this bill passes or whether the commission takes it upon itself, I think as we opened up recently a value of solar docket, there have been similar comments that perhaps the commission doesn't fully value the benefits of energy storage. And so at this point, I think it's fair to argue that arguably the analysis that the commission is not mature with regard to energy storage, because frankly there haven't been a whole lot of opportunities to look at them.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jason.
Thank you.
Okay, no other questions. I am closing a public hearing on House Bill 2193. And I'm closing this meeting of the House Energy and Environment Committee.
Here's my half gavel.